A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to take those big, complex ideas and really break them down into the essential knowledge that you can actually use.
And today we're tackling something that sounds, well, almost like a contradiction in terms to the British Constitution. People often call it unwritten.
Right, and that word unwritten immediately makes you think it's maybe vague or a bit old-fashioned or maybe just, you know, a bit of a mess.
A mess is exactly the perception Martin Laughlin pushes back against. He's one of the UK's most respected constitutional scholars.
And we're diving into his really significant book, The British Constitution. His argument that this system isn't messy. Actually, it's a remarkably flexible, sophisticated alternative to the written constitutions most countries have.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to get past that surface paradox. We want to help you understand the sort of hidden logic, maybe even the genius of an uncodified system.
Yeah. How does it achieve stability? How does it maintain legitimacy using things like political restraint, rather than just relying on a single legal text?
And look, this isn't just some abstract debate. Think about the UK over the last, say, 10, 15 years. You've got Brexit, which was huge.
Huge. And still ongoing in many ways.
Then there are the constant tensions around devolution, Scotland, Northern Ireland.
Plus those really high-profile Supreme Court cases challenging government decisions.
Right. So the big question is, how does a major democracy, a global player, navigate all this intense political stress without one single document everyone points to? How does it hold together?
Okay, let's start to unpack this. To really grasp how resilient this system can be, we need to understand the framework Laughlin offers.
Absolutely. And Martin Laughlin is, well, he's a really major figure in public law. He holds the chair in public law at the London School of Economics, LSE.
He's been thinking and writing about this for a long time. But what makes his take so interesting, I think, is that he doesn't just look at it as a lawyer would.
Exactly. His work is very, well, it pulls from different fields. It's interdisciplinary. He brings in history, political theory, alongside the legal analysis.
Which you absolutely have to do, right? Because, as we'll see, you just can't understand the British Constitution by only reading statutes or court cases. You need the political culture, the history behind it.
Precisely. And he's a key advocate for a particular way of thinking called political constitutionalism.
Okay, political constitutionalism. What does that mean in simple terms?
It fundamentally argues that the ultimate authority, the final say in the state, should rest with the democratic political process. Think parliament, elections, accountability to voters.
So it's not primarily the courts acting as the ultimate guardians, like in the U.S. system where the Supreme Court can strike down laws.
That's the core difference he emphasizes. In his view, the courts and judicial review are secondary. The real integrity of the British model, he argues, comes from the fact that political actors, the government, MPs, are the ones ultimately responsible for upholding the Constitution.
And if they fail?
Well, the ultimate check is political. They get voted out. So his book is really a deep theoretical defense of this model, arguing its strength lies in that political accountability.
Right. Let's turn to the book itself then. Laughlin kicks off by basically saying, hold on, the idea that Britain lacks a proper constitution, that's wrong.
Yeah, he reframes it. It's not a deficit, it's just different.
Yes.
A sophisticated alternative way of doing constitutional government.
And the central argument, the main thesis, is what?
It's that the UK constitution is fundamentally political, not primarily legal. Its essence, its character, comes from centuries of political struggle, compromise, adaptation. Continuous practice, really.
Going way back.
Way back, especially to this settlement after the Glorious Revolution in the 17th century. He sees it as a constitution shaped by evolution, not by revolutionary moments creating rigid texts.
And he actually gives this process a name, doesn't he? Political jurisprudence.
He does. It sounds a bit academic, maybe.
A little bit.
But it just means the system works through this unique blend, the synthesis of formal legal ideas and day-to-day political reality. And he traces that specific blend right back to 1688, which settled where ultimate political power really lay.
Okay, so that historical foundation leads us to the absolute cornerstone legal principle of the whole system.
Parliamentary sovereignty.
Right. You can't talk about the British Constitution without talking about this. How does Laughlin break it down?
He explains it has two core parts. First, Parliament legally has the power to make or unmake any law it wants on absolutely any subject.
No limits. legally speaking.
Legally, no inherent limits imposed by a higher constitutional text. And second, crucially, no other body, not the courts, not anyone, is legally recognized as having the power to override or invalidate Parliament's laws.
And that goes back to 1688.
That's the historical root. The settlement established the King and Parliament, now effectively the Crown, acting through Parliament as the supreme legal authority. Its legitimacy today flows from the democratic bit, the elected MPs in the House of Commons.
Okay, so if Parliament's power is legally unlimited, what stops a government with a big majority from just running roughshod over everything, doing outrageous things? Where are the checks and balances we hear about?
And that's where Laughlin brings in the crucial role of the informal rules, the unwritten stuff. Constitutional conventions.
Constitutional conventions. These sound important, but maybe a bit nebulous.
Right.
Especially if you're used to everything being written down.
They can seem that way, but they are absolutely vital. Think of them as the established, unwritten rules and practices that everyone involved in government feels bound to follow.
Like what? Give us some examples.
Well, things like ministerial responsibility. The idea that ministers are accountable to Parliament for their departments. Or the fundamental convention that the monarch only acts on the advice of the government ministers.
Or that a government has to resign if it loses a major vote of confidence in Parliament.
Exactly. These aren't laws in the strict sense, but they are the grease in the wheels. They ensure the government operates smoothly and, crucially, legitimately. They are the political norms that have become constitutionally binding through practice.
What's really interesting, though, is how they're enforced. If they're not laws, you can't go to court and sue someone for breaking a convention, right?
Correct. The enforcement mechanism is purely political.
So what stops a prime minister just ignoring one they don't like?
The consequences. Things like political shame, losing the respect of colleagues, facing intense media criticism, pressure from within their own party, maybe triggering a leadership challenge, or ultimately losing public trust in the next election.
It's about political cost, not legal penalty.
Precisely. Laughlin argues these conventions are essential. They bridge that gap between the absolute legal sovereignty of Parliament and the need for practical political restraint in how that power is used. They turn how we usually do things into how we must do things constitutionally.
Okay, moving from the rules to the structure, Laughlin also looks closely at the structure of government itself. And he challenges that idea of a strict separation of powers that many people assume is standard in democracies.
Yeah, he highlights that the UK's Westminster model is based on a fusion of powers, not separation.
Fusion.
Meaning
the executive branch, the prime minister, the cabinet is actually drawn from the legislature, from Parliament. They are MPs or lords themselves. They sit in Parliament.
Which is totally different from the U.S., for example, where the president and Congress are very separate institutions.
Completely different. In the U.K., the government and Parliament are intertwined.
Now, some critics have famously worried about this. Didn't Lord Hailsham call it an elective dictatorship because a government with a majority seems to control Parliament? If the executive comes from Parliament, how does Parliament effectively hold it to account?
And that's Laughlin's point again. The check isn't a formal legal wall between branches. It's those political mechanisms we've been talking about.
Such as constant parliamentary scrutiny, think about prime minister's questions, intense debates, select committees, grilling ministers, and also the opposition's role in challenging the government.
And fundamentally, the need to face the voters again.
Yes. The ever-present need to maintain public confidence and win the next election. So the government might have immense legal power via Parliament, but its political authority is always conditional, always being tested.
Let's bring this up to the modern day. Laughlin addresses how this system adapts, right? Particularly in Chapter 6, he uses the Human Rights Act of 1998, the HRA, as a key example. How did the system handle incorporating modern human rights law?
He sees the HRA, which brought the European Convention on Human Rights into UK domestic law, as a really clever piece of constitutional engineering, a compromise.
How so? How did it balance protecting rights with maintaining that core principle of parliamentary sovereignty?
Okay, here's the mechanism. The HRA does allow UK judges to review legislation and check if it complies with the convention rights.
So judges can strike down laws they think violate human rights.
No, and this is the crucial Laughlin point that preserves the political constitution. If judges find a law incompatible with a convention right, they can issue what's called a declaration of incompatibility.
A declaration. So it doesn't actually invalidate the law. It doesn't just disappear from the statute books.
Exactly. The law remains legally valid, but the declaration sends a massive public signal to Parliament.
Ah, so it kicks off a political process.
Precisely. It puts intense political pressure on the government and parliament to reconsider the law and probably change it. But the final decision whether to amend the law, repeal it, or even ignore the declaration still rests with the sovereign political body, with parliament.
So a court's raise a flag, start a conversation, but parliament has the last word.
That's the essence of it. It respects rights, gives judges a role, but keeps ultimate authority with the elected legislature. It's a political dialogue prompted by judicial review.
And I suppose if you want the most dramatic, recent example of parliament asserting its ultimate sovereignty,
it has to be Brexit.
Right. Regardless of one's views on it, constitutionally speaking.
Constitutionally, Brexit was a profound demonstration of parliamentary sovereignty in action. Parliament, prompted by a referendum itself, a political act, chose to unpick an entire complex legal order, EU law, that it had previously chosen to join. It showed that Parliament could, legally, do anything, even leave the EU.
Okay, let's step back and pull out some key themes from all this. What's the first major takeaway for someone listening?
I think it has to be the primacy of the political. What Laughlin really hammers home is that the ultimate rules of the game in the UK system are political facts, political realities.
Not just words in a legal document.
Right. The system is constrained and shaped primarily by elections, by political debate, by those conventions, not by rigid legal formulas enforced by courts as the final arbiter.
And the second theme seems to be about flexibility or adaptability.
Yes, Laughlin presents the uncodified nature not as a weakness, but as a major strength. It allows for what he calls evolutionary adaptation, meaning when society changes or new challenges arise, the Constitution can adjust gradually through shifts in practice, new conventions, or specific legislation without needing a huge, potentially divisive formal amendment process like you have with written constitutions.
So it avoids the rigidity that can sometimes plague codified systems, making updates difficult.
That's the argument. It allows for smoother change, potentially avoiding major constitutional crises just to make necessary adjustments.
And the third big theme.
It's the deep integration of law and politics. You just can't understand the British Constitution if you try to separate the two. It lives in that dynamic interplay between the formal legal rules, like parliamentary sovereignty, and all those informal political practices and conventions.
You need both sides of the coin.
Absolutely. Understanding one without the other gives you a completely distorted picture.
Laughlin is also quite good at phrasing things memorably, isn't he? There are some lines in the book that really stick.
He really is. He manages to capture complex ideas quite elegantly.
One that stands out for me, summing up that political nature, is the British Constitution exists not as text, but as practice.
That's a great one. It forces you, doesn't it? It says, stop looking just at the documents. Look at what political actors actually do, day in, day out. That's where the Constitution lives.
And another one captures that core principle we discussed. Parliamentary sovereignty is both the foundation and the limit of constitutional authority.
Yeah, that highlights the kind of self-regulating paradox. Sovereignty establishes the ultimate legal authority, but the very nature of that doctrine, resting on political acceptance, also implicitly defines its practical limits.
And one more, defining those unwritten rules. Constitutional conventions transform political practice into constitutional obligation.
That neatly explains how mere habits or ways of doing things politically gain real constitutional weight over time if they're consistently followed and accepted as binding. They become rules, even without a judge enforcing them.
So thinking about real-life applications for people listening, how does this understanding help us?
Well, for anyone following UK politics, it gives you a much better toolkit for making sense of crises or controversies.
How so?
When you see a big clash, say, between the government and the Supreme Court, or a heated debate about devolution powers for Scotland or Wales, you can see it not just as a legal dispute, but as part of this ongoing political negotiation over the boundaries of power within the political constitution.
So when someone in the UK shouts, that's unconstitutional, It might not mean that breaks a specific law.
Often it means that violates a long-standing political norm, a convention, a tradition of how we expect power to be exercised. It's a political accusation as much as, or sometimes more than, a legal one.
And what about for people looking at the UK from the outside, global observers?
I think the book offers a really important case study. It shows a different model of successful, stable democratic governance, one that prioritizes political flexibility and accountability over rigid legal certainty.
It makes you think, doesn't it? About whether other democracies maybe rely too heavily on courts and legal frameworks, potentially at the expense of developing robust political checks and maturity.
It certainly raises that question about the different ways you can design a stable and legitimate democratic system. There isn't just one blueprint.
Okay, final takeaways then. What was the most surprising or illuminating thing for you from diving into Laughlin's work again?
For me, it's always that reframing of the unwritten nature, moving from seeing it as a lack, a deficit, to understanding it as a potentially sophisticated, intentional feature designed for adaptation.
Yeah, that's powerful. The idea that the strength might actually come from the absence of rigid walls, forcing continuous political negotiation and compromise, It's quite counterintuitive at first.
And the lasting insight, I think, is broader. It's that constitutional government, wherever you are, is ultimately about creating and sustaining legitimate authority.
How do you make people accept the rules of the game?
Exactly. And Laughlin shows how the British system achieves that legitimacy through its unique blend of law, deep-rooted political practices, and traditions. It works, fundamentally, because the key political actors, and by extension the public, accept its processes and outcomes most of the time. That acceptance, not just ink on paper, is what makes it endure.
A really thoughtful place to end. Thanks so much for unpacking all that.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating system to grapple with.
It certainly is. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.